With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. You're with Mike Ryan on today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
And it's a Tuesday for those that have slept in the States. It's still Monday, heading towards the Tuesday. And on the planet Mars, I've got no idea just that I would say that because I've been watching a lot of science fiction films on TV and they're all very exciting. I love those sci-fi films. Speaking of sci-fi, the midterms are coming very quickly now in the US, the midterms in November. And the poll shows a big shift in party preference for US midterms. The Democrats, very sad, have slipped from a 7-point lead. Now, how did they get to a 7-point lead? Maybe it was a bit of bias from the parts of the US government, maybe. Anyway, a 7-point lead down to a 3-point deficit heading into the congressional election. U.S. voter concerns over issues such as inflation and crime appear to be giving the Republicans an edge over Democrats heading into November's midterm congressional elections, a new poll has revealed. It's the Monmouth University poll, which was conducted in late September and released on Monday. It has showed that 47% of Americans prefer that Republicans regain control of Congress, compared with 44%. Who want the Democrats to remain in charge. The September result marked a major shift from just 1 month earlier when Democrats held, a 50-43 lead over Republicans. It says one of two things. The Republicans have also lost touch with their voters, with the citizens of America. And the second thing, which is probably more to the point, don't believe it. It's a bunch of lies. Again, just as Joe Biden won the presidential election. He did not. They cheated. It was stolen. I will say that till I go blue in the face. It was stolen. It was a sham election. And yet they go on with what's happened in Ukraine with those four territories that had the referenda. And it showed that the people wanted to be part of Russia. And now they're in fear of their lives and they've been bombed just mercifully. They've just been annihilated by Ukraine's firing upon, which were, until a week ago, Ukrainians. But nothing much had changed. The only difference is now that they're part of Russia and it should be legally recognised, not only by the US and other NATO countries, but also by Australia. So Penny Wong, get that scalpel out and remove that skin that is attaching you to Jake Sullivan, Joe Biden, and the rest of those terrible, terrible people. Terrible name for them too, Democrats. Nothing like a democratic process at all. Now, another thing which you'll be quite perturbed about, I am anyway, in Germany, the Greens are destroying Germany's ancient forests to make way for industrial wind turbines. To make way for over 30,000 of these things, that's those things that kill birds or chop whales in half if they're plonked in the ocean, destroy the planet to save it. To make way for over 30,000 of these things, the German wind industry has ruthlessly clear-felled ancient forest once considered out of bounds. Provided the wilderness being turned into smouldering ash is used as a platform for hundreds of 260-metre-high, 300-ton industrial juggernauts. And by the way, it's all for the greater good. This beautiful forest, you're going to plonk these terrible windmills that just chop birds up and provide nothing, just about nothing, to provide energy for the Germans and the rest of Europe. And by the way, think about it. Part of the reason why is because the power lines they use are high-density power lines, and the energy that they're trying to get through those lines are low-density, which means that they don't work very well at all. So a couple of really interesting things happening in the world. Now, don't miss out on a thing. Be sure to download the TNT Radio app from either the Apple App Store or Google Play so you can easily listen live to us anywhere, anytime, even in the bathroom. It's available right now to download. By the way, we're keeping you up to speed on TNT Radio.
It's the stuff.
It's that division
people are talking about.
And that cluelessness that they want to push.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Now, former U.S. presidential or president Donald Trump and the future president, because he'll win the next one if he runs for it, who knows, might be DeSantis. But anyway, at this stage, Donald looks like he's the front runner and the next president of the U.S. He's suing his media arch nemesis. That's News Channel. Well, not really a news channel. The voice for the other side, CNN, for defamation, demanding only $475 million for allegedly weaponizing its reputation as a reliable source to destroy his own. And anybody knows that CNN, which has two or three people watching and a couple of dogs, has nobody watching, basically CNN. The real, I mean, so what he's saying is that they slurred him pretending to be a real news channel. The real estate mogul turned Republican politician filed the suit on Monday in the U.S. District Court of the Southern District of Florida. Now, more news on that with our news producer, Sonia Bailey. Sonia, tell us about this and a lot more with the Donald.
Thank you, Mike. So the complaint and the jury demand that was filed yesterday by Donald Trump against CNN, it states that beyond simply highlighting any negative information about Trump and ignoring all positive information about him, CNN has sought to use its massive influence purportedly as a trusted news source to defame Trump in the minds of its viewers and readers for the purpose of defeating him politically. Now, that's sort of the opening statement of the actual filing, and I have read it in full. I think what's kind of interesting about this is this would not be the first case of Trump having something terrible said about him or Trump being spoken poorly of by a particular media outlet. So it's interesting that he has felt that the justification for what CNN has dished up to him warrants a $475 million settlement. And it is quite a long lawsuit. It's 29 pages. And he claims in this 29-page lawsuit that CNN had a long track record of criticizing him, but had ramped up its attacks in recent months because allegedly the network feared that he would run again for presidency in 2024. So as you mentioned, you know, if he does run again, he has quite a high probability of success, provided that it is a fair and just election. So I think that that's where, looking at the suit in its entirety, we have very many aspects sort of coming out. As you know, as you mentioned, CNN is probably not high on the list of reputable, reliable news outlets, and some of the terminology that CNN used that Trump has claimed has caused defamation and caused him harm and caused actual malice warranting this suit probably isn't anything we haven't heard him be called before.
Yeah, I'm just thinking the CNN along with MSNBC, NBC, CBS, ABC, PBS, of course, along with the rest of most of Western media, have really gone after Trump. In the States, you can say a lot more and get away with it. Whereas, say, if you're in Australia, if they had said what they said about, say, a prime minister, the prime minister would be in court in 5 seconds. What do you think about, do you think that the prime minister in Australia or politicians should be protected, or should there be a more open slather, as is with the case in the US?
Well, I think this almost comes down to a freedom of speech issue, because I think that when we look at legislation from country to country differs, and in Australia we do have legislation around what a politician can say about another politician. So I think that when we're referring to news and media outlets, and then separately we're referring to elected politicians, and then of course we have the community at large. There's different rules around what they're allowed to say and what they're allowed to actually claim about each other. So I think that when these sorts of rules or legislations come into play, I think this is where Trump suit really needs to narrow down. Were these things stated about him as a person, or were these things stated about him as a politician? Because those would really fall into two different categories. Now, the complaint says that CNN used scandalous labels to destroy the former president's image for its audience. And some of the terminology that is quoted in the suit is racist, Russian lackey, insurrectionist, Hitler. And it's the last terminology of, CNN referring to Trump as Hitler that has sort of crossed that line into determining that actual malice was being used, as opposed to sort of generic terms like bigot. Or so I think that this is where he really is going to need to prove in court that what CNN has done goes beyond this sort of freedom of speech and media opinion, and actually transitions into a narrative that is causing damage or has caused damage.
Mm.
And in his suit, he does say that. Whether he can prove that would possibly be another matter to address.
Yeah, they do say nasty things, but I'm sure in front of the judge, if he gets up and says, look, they said nasty things about me, Your Honour, he'd probably tell him to grow up. But however, having said that, the nasty things are quite vicious. You mentioned Hitler, the Russian collusionist, joined at the hip with Putin and stuff. I mean, if you look at it, it's the Democrats. Look at Hillary. Nothing's been said about that. I mean, they all and have now recognised that it was Hillary and Jake Sullivan that leaked all this information about how Donald was being fed information, dollars and all sorts of favours from Putin and his allies in Russia. And he spent most of his presidential reign trying to just defend himself against those ridiculous and absolutely obscene suggestions. Yet nothing has been said about those scurrilous claims. And I suppose part of this suit with CNN is also to try and put those to bed. I'm sure the Mar-a-Lago raid and all this will be brought up to and on wasn't it interesting how CNN were there when the FBI raided Mar-a-Lago? So, I mean, you got those things.
It's like they had a crystal ball and knew it was going to occur.
That's right. Look into my teacup. But Trump also is being sued for I think this will be thrown out, but $250 million, which is about $320 million Australian, for alleging fraudulent business practices in the state of New York for saying that he was bigger than he is. I mean, if you go to New York, most of the people in New York tell you that they're bigger than they really are. So all he was doing, what they practice, is in New York. I mean, I don't think they'll go that far in getting him for saying that he was bigger than he was, because that's what they do in New York and most of the states. They're very proud of themselves and they do exaggerate at times their importance.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think, anybody who has the sort of money that Trump has and the sort of public influence that he has as well, this type of lawsuit, both the one that he's lodged and the one that he has against him, this is his prime opportunity to actually get some truth out there and have some things put on essentially a public record that he may not have had the opportunity to disclose previously, either because of his status as essentially someone famous or as his running as a politician and being in the political seat. This kind of becomes his opportunity to set the record straight a little bit on a few of these subjects. So it's going to be very interesting as this lawsuit unfolds, and obviously the one that he has pending against him, as these unfold and we begin to see some of the truth come out, it's going to be very interesting to see what results actually come from it and what information is disclosed as to what ends up being redacted. Given that CNN has made no mention at all of this suit from Trump, it's going to be very interesting to see what truth comes to light.
Well, I think CNN wouldn't say much anyway, because they only report what they want their audience to know. And in this case, they definitely don't want their two men and a dog or two dogs knowing that they're being sued for for enhancing lies, and that's what it was. Hey, what are your thoughts, but before we get out of this break, what are your thoughts on the insurrection, the January 6th insurrection, and then the consequent raids of various you know, fairly prominent and not so prominent Republicans, those that visited the Capitol on January 6th. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think the this thing will just dwindle out, or do you think it's going to ramp up even more as the midterms get closer?
Look, I think it's one of, I think you just hit the nail on the head already when you said that CNN only covers what they want people to hear and what they want to know. And I think that as far as the events of January 6th, both perceived and actual, the media is only going to cover what they want us to know. The governing bodies are only going to go after the people that they want to go after, and everybody else will be swept under the rug.
Mm.
Prime example is Hunter Biden's laptop, Epstein's shopping list.
Mm.
Things disappear if they need to disappear, and things are exposed if they need to be exposed. Unfortunately, it's rarely the citizens that need to hear the truth that are the ones that actually end up hearing it.
Yeah, it's a pretty sad state of affairs, journalism these days, but who knows, maybe maybe in our next life we'll start to experience what journalism used to be like. I mean, you're, what are you, 22, 23, so you're probably too young for that to understand that once upon a time, journalism used to be all about the truth and telling the truth, uncovering the lies. Nowadays, it seems to be the opposite. Sonia Bailey, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Mike.
This is TNT Radio.
You should hear what Jason Allbourn is talking about.
On Sky News just yesterday, Paul Murray came out with a story talking about how in Australia, our children have never had higher levels of depression and anxiety in this country. And Murray was asking his guests, how is it? Never had more wealth. We're in peacetime. I don't know where he got that one from. And why is that our kids feel this way? Well, doctor will tell you diet and exercise helps, but it's not the same for every individual, of course, is it? Because as we know, also sports people can get depressed too. And medication will not make one vital. Neither does indoctrination in schools, the bastion of forced monoculture, nor does hearing ad nauseum that the price of housing is out of reach. And that breeds hopelessness. Mum and dad spend their lives trying to pay off their house before they retire and die. How could that ever motivate anyone, any child, to believe that housing prices are astronomically going up exponentially? And I'm meant to compete. I don't know anything, and I've got to go out there and find a career and a job and rest. And it's all getting too hard. No wonder the kids feel the way they do.
Jason Allbourn and Jason Q. Citizen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Let's take advantage of the freedoms that we have while we have them to advance the kingdom's objective, to be salt and light.
Freedom is hard. Election security involves you, involves the voters.
This election for people of faith is vital that we see a change, because the war against Christians is at an all-time high.
Transparency is the key not only to having honest elections, but to maintaining public trust in those elections.
Our ability to vote is not being withheld from us. No one's trying to stop you from voting.
The one place the American people can have a say is at the ballot box. That's why the Democrats and the far left are working so hard to get rid of all election integrity.
We cannot let our elections be anything but transparent. It is at the very heart of freedom in a free society.
And if we lose America, I mean, it's all over, because the world has looked to America for hope.
Free and fair at salemnow.com.
The Great Reinfection.
With thanks to the COVID vaccine.
COVID vaccines are not safe and don't work. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Now, there are rumors on Twitter that some international banks are not in healthy positions. It appears one may be in what you would say is deep doo-doos, deep trouble. Swiss banking giant Credit Suisse is that particular bank. Now, are the problems particular to Credit Suisse, or could its demise trigger a domino effect on otherwise healthy institutions? But North is principal of digital finance analytics, which analyzes data to provide insight into the dynamics of the mortgage, lending, savings payments and superannuation industries. Martin also keeps an eye on international developments, which impact greatly on Australia's financial markets. Martin, thanks for joining us.
Mike.
Now, can you tell us more about Credit Suisse and the significance of this story? And even though they are denying it, but when you have a CEO coming out saying, don't panic, it's like the Titanic. Don't jump yet. They're in trouble, aren't they?
Well, there's certainly some rumours around the place. Let's just stand back a little bit and think about the types of banks that are out there. So we have retail banks, you know, the people who are making mortgages and deposits for ordinary businesses and households. And you have corporate banking, which essentially is providing banking services to the larger corporates. And then you have investment banking. And investment banking are basically the sporty part of the financial system. And what they are doing is spending a lot of time and effort not only providing quite sophisticated, let's call it financial engineering to particularly large corporates, but they also are trading on their own behalf. And so investment banks are looking for additional ways to make money. And whilst your typical bank is mortgage and those sorts of things, which has a margin, many investment banks are reliant on taking bets as to where the markets are going. And whether you look at bonds or some of the derivative services, that's where they are effectively playing. Now, there are 30 globally significant investment banks or international banks, the G-SIBs, mostly investment banks. And Credit Suisse is one of the 30. And that list was declared by our old friends, the Bank for International Settlements and the Financial Stability Board. So these are sort of global entities that looked around and said, where are the potential risks in the banking system? Because the banking system ultimately is a set of plumbing that works internationally. It's not just within geographic boundaries. Mm. And so they've named 30 organizations across the globe that actually are significantly more risky than normal. And Credit Suisse is on the list. It's actually, alongside a few others, JP Morgan is regarded as the most risky. And then you've got people like Citigroup, a little less risky. And then Credit Suisse, alongside ING and a few others, are all slightly below that. But they are highlighted as being more risky. Now, the next thing to understand is that these risks are actually offset by higher credit requirements. So they have to hold essentially more buffers to sort of buffer their situation. But with that said, there is a great risk of some of these investment banks, particularly those who've taken significant positions because of the volatility in the markets that we've seen around the world. And as a result of that, there is a risk they could be on the wrong side of the trade or their derivatives portfolios could be going in the wrong direction. And that is the real question, because, of course, in recent times, we've seen massive questions about what's been going on, particularly if you look at the bond markets recently. And then if you look at Credit Suisse in particular, one of the measures is a thing called a credit default swap price. That's a signal of how much risk there is in the system. And the market risk assessment of Credit Suisse has gone up dramatically. Why? Well, partly because of these international exposures, but also because they're in the middle of a strategic review. And in fact, the CEO came out and said, what we want to do is to rise like a phoenix from the ashes, which sort of says, hang on a moment, what have you got then? What have you got now, right? Mm. And then he put out another message to say, we've got plenty of liquidity. We are facing a critical moment as we go through the overhaul, but don't panic. And then he told employees, we're sending them regular updates as to what's going on. And of course, that immediately spooked the horses because they're saying, well, hang on a moment, if you're saying that, what's going on? Nobody really knows. And, the rumor mill has been running overtime. But because of the fact that this is a G-SIB, if it's actually wobbly, it not only impacts Swiss banking, but it's globally significant. Mm. And that's why this is an important conversation.
Interesting. I'm just looking at some of the highlights of Credit Suisse with their over the last bunch of years. 86, they had fake names of Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos. 99, the Tokyo shredding party, which probably was also resembled that at the next board meeting, they would have been shredded. Then you had Sani Abaka, a Nigerian military leader who stole millions and millions. Then you had, of course, the Yakuza up there with the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. That was in 2004. Then in 2019, Bulgarian cocaine. I mean, why would you, unless you have an inclination to the darker side, why would you do any business with them?
Well, the issue is, I think most of these large G-SIBs, these large investment banks, have shadiness around the edge because they're in it to make money, right? And frankly, they'll do almost anything. They'll sell their grandmother if they can make money. And because of the fact that interest rates have been so low, a lot of it is really looking for the deal. And, you know, if the deal shades into things which you could say, well, is that close to the wind or not? Maybe they just step over the line some. It's hard to know. And then the question is, do they have the right internal checks and balances to make sure that they don't cross over the line? And unfortunately, in recent years, we've seen many proceedings against quite a few of these investment banks where they've crossed the line. Mm. Why? Because they're driven by profit and profit only. And that's one of the problems I've got, is that if you've got an investment banking operation wedded to a typical bank, you know, and some of the banking operations in Australia have both retail and wholesale and investment banking, the risk is, do you actually have greater risk in your investment bank? And does that then spill over into the rest of the banking system? And there's an argument to say that we should separate out this investment banking shenanigans from meat and potato banking, but that's not what happens. But there's big questions here about their role. And are they too big to fail because they span internationally? You know, they're sort of above country control. And so you've got to ask the question, how moral are they?
I mean, you could also have part B to that, just before our news headlines, how moral are the other banks? Just the normal. But that's, we'll talk about that after the break. This is TNT Radio.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. Poland has formally demanded $1.2 trillion in compensation from Germany for damages it caused during the Second World War. Almost 1.5 million people have been arrested in Beijing in a 3-month public security crackdown ahead of the national meeting of the Chinese Communist Party. And residents in Japan were ordered to seek immediate shelter on Tuesday morning after North Korea fired an intermediate-range ballistic missile toward the country.
Don't miss a thing. Be sure to download the TNT Radio app from either the Apple App Store or Google Play so you can easily listen live to us anywhere, anytime. Available right now to download. Keeping you up to speed on TNT Radio.
And Martin North is my guest, Principal of Digital Finance Analytics. I'm just looking at some of the, the highlights of Credit Suisse. It's the Nigerian military leader, the Yakuza, Bulgarian cocaine. What happens if they go broke? I mean, if Credit Suisse becomes just basically unable to trade, you wouldn't want those sort of customers paying you a visit, would you? Where's my money? Where's my money?
Yeah, well, that's true. And look, the fact is that if one of these large G-SIBs got into deep trouble, this would be a huge shock. You know, you may remember Lehman from, you know, the global financial crisis. And people have been saying, well, is this a Lehman moment? I don't think it is yet. But the point about this is the Lehman crisis and, you know, the global financial crisis stemmed from two issues. One, greed, which is what we're seeing here. Mm-hmm. And the other is that people didn't understand the risks that they were getting involved in and essentially were assuming that everything was fine when it wasn't. Now, is the same thing happening now? That's really the critical question. And, you know, with everything going around the world in terms of volatility and in terms of, you know, the movements of exchange rates and bond prices, you know, very significant moves recently, the risk is that some of these organizations could be on the wrong side of the trade. And just to give you one example, the derivatives sector, which is where you are basically taking a bet on where you think future rates are going to go, either interest rates or exchange rates or both, they have a multiplying factor, because essentially what you are doing is margin leverage into these things. So you can have huge exposures. And if the markets move in the wrong direction, then those exposures could essentially wipe out all your capital. Mm. Now, as I said, G-SIBs have higher levels of capital, and next year they're going to have even higher levels. But there are risks. Do they know fully the risks that they've actually got? Do they have the right controls inside their organization? And do they have the right moral compass? And I don't think that some of these investment banks really are actually fit for purpose at the moment. And I don't think necessarily they've actually got what I would regard as a moral compass in what they do. They're out to make money at all costs.
How do we assess whether a bank is in a good posse or not? Are there indicators other than a declining share price? And I suppose we could put, I mean, we say we are protected here in this country. You just wonder how much protection we do really have in reality. And then part B of that one is also the investment banks we're talking about.
Well, so there's a couple of things. They have to make regular reports, of course, accounting reports. Those reports are independently validated by some of the big accounting firms. But as you know, and I know, that sometimes the accounting firms will be persuaded to position information in a particular way for the benefit of the client. It's not totally objective and independent. So I have a problem with the auditing and reporting. The second is, do they know all the risks that they've actually got? Because what you have to do is what's called mark to market. So, you know, every time you want to know what the risks are, you have to say, what is the current price of my portfolio? Right. And then from there, you can work out how the portfolio moved from last time. And then you can work out what the risks are in the portfolio because of the price moves. But that is a very complicated thing to do. And so the question is, have you got the right systems and processes to be able to actually calculate the true risks in the system? The final point is, all these investment banks have relationships with other investment banks. And so what tends to happen is it's like a sort of a whole bunch of spaghetti with all of these different banks connected with each other and also connected very strongly with the central banks as well. So it's not that everything is ring-fenced within one organization. You know, there are what's called counterparty risk with the other players in the system. So if one falls over or effectively fails to do the things that, you know, you would expect it to do, the contagion risk is the problem. And that's why these are G-SIBs, because essentially the powers that be said, these organizations are big enough to wreck the global economy if they go wrong. And that's why they've got more significant supervision and higher capital requirements. The question is it enough? Well, we won't know until something goes wrong.
How is the health then of the international banking sector? I mean, do you see, I mean, I suppose it's not in your nature to look at the doomsday scenario when it comes to this sort of stuff, unless you've had a few drinks. And in that case, reality may be a lot more apparent. But do you see, how secure is the banking system? Do you see a doomsday scenario around the corner that it will go beyond a recession and more into something a little more severe?
Well, there's certainly significant risk, and I think the risks are probably higher today than they've been in recent times. Remember, we went through the very significant quantitative easing cycle from the central banks, which basically lifted the amount of debt around the world. Lots of bonds were issued, and those bonds were actually bought by central banks. And a lot of the investment banks made quite handsome trading profits. And in fact, if you look carefully over the last few years, a lot of these banks have made a lot of their profit from trading. But now things are changing with interest rates rising. So we are seeing lower levels of liquidity. In other words, number of people wanting to buy and sell bonds in the market. Mm-hmm. That puts more pressure on the spreads between the buying and selling side of the bonds. And that puts pressure on these banks. And if you recall the Bank of England and the pension system in the UK last week, the Bank of England needed to intervene because the pension funds who actually were reliant on these long-term bonds were actually seeing the value of those bonds drop in half. Now, I don't think that many of these large financial institutions can live with the value of their assets dropping by 50%. That would be huge if it stuck, which is why the Bank of England then intervened and said, right, well, we'll start doing quantitative easing again, and rather than quantitative tightening, we'll throw more money and liquidity into the system to support the pension funds in the UK, the £1 trillion of long-term bonds in the UK. So we are, I think, at a very precipitous stage of our financial system. I'd also make a couple of other points. We also have China's banking system, which is part of the global banking system, also quite close to the edge with what's been going on in China. And in fact, some people would argue that the most tricky risks in the banking system are within the Chinese economy and the Chinese banking system, which is huge. But I'd argue that actually the Eurozone is probably even more exposed. Why? Because they were running negative interest rate strategies for quite a few years, and quite a few of the banks there could only make profit from trading. And they were desperate to make trades, so they actually chased deals that you probably shouldn't have chased. Mm-hmm. And so those deals could all come unwound now with all of these changes in interest rates and exchange rates and things. So we don't know the full amount. And look, frankly, the disclosure levels, I think, are pretty low still. And, you know, they produce their accounts every quarter and every year and claim everything's fine. And the CEOs come out and say, nothing to see here. But I just remind you that that was what was happening with Lehman before they went over, right? And so there is, I think, a question about degree of transparency versus degree of risk. And the bottom line is this: even our banking system in Australia is not separated completely from these global players, because quite a few of the Australian banks have counterparty risk with some of these international banks. So if those international banks went wrong, that could hit our local banks. And that could create then a real problem here with financial stability. And remember what I said about the fact that if you've got a retail bank and a commercial bank and an investment bank under the same roof, if you start making big losses in your investment bank, well, guess what? That bank can then only reach for the rest of their organization, you know, the deposits that we've got and those sorts of things. And that takes us into the conversation about deposit bail-in and, you know, the risks and issues around that. Because if you go back to the global financial crisis, banks were rescued around the world by effectively governments taking them over and privatizing them, you know, moving them from the private sector to the public sector, public ownership, like, for example, National Westminster Bank in the UK, or the Royal Bank of Scotland, as it was. They decided that that wasn't a good thing to do again. So now that they're trying to find alternative workout strategies, so if a bank gets into trouble, these investment banks should have a workout strategy. Now, that workout strategy may or may not require rather unconventional things, like, for example, taking deposits and saying, well, actually, those are unsecured loans to the bank, so we're going to convert them into equity to make our equity higher. Those sorts of things are theoretical risks, even if they're not actually practical risks.
Tell me about, I mean, I always used to think that the British quid was always, you know, a very secure and very a nice piece of paper. and the US was nicer, but not as big and as colourful. The British pound's taken a bit of a battering. But tell us the story about this and how this will affect, you know, not just the EU and the UK, but how it will affect the rest of the world.
Well, yeah, we should look at this. You know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago, the UK government came out and basically said, we are going to borrow somewhere around £45 billion from the markets, and we're going to reduce the tax rate for, you know, those wealthy and do a lot of other things that will actually create growth in the UK economy. And, well, the IMF came out and said, well, actually, what you're doing is you're creating greater disparity between the rich and the poor, and you're actually doing it at a time when many people are struggling because of the high energy costs, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And the what happened there was the exchange rate to the US dropped from about 111 to about 103, the worst, which is horrendous for the pound, right? And worse still, the 30-year bonds, the long-term bonds I mentioned earlier on, they went from about 3% to close to 5.5%. And the point about the yield on a bond, it's an inverse relationship to the price of the bond. So bonds dropped by 50%. And a lot of those were held by the pension funds. And the pension funds then said, well, hang on a moment, what we're going to do? The only thing we can do is actually to sell more bonds to meet the margin calls that we're being asked to make because of these moves, right? And that's why the Bank of England had to intervene. And they then said, right, well, what we're going to do is we're going to actually issue a directive to say that we will buy bonds up to a certain amount, so quantitative easing, which is what we had previously, to keep the financial stability risks in check. So that's what's all happened. And that works. The exchange rate came up a little bit and the bonds rate came down a little bit. And then over the last weekend, the Prime Minister, the new Prime Minister in the UK, said, no, we're still going to stick to this strategy. But then 24 hours later, the Treasurer said, no, we're not. We're actually going to not do the tax cut, which then immediately turned the markets on their heads. So suddenly that exchange rate went back up to where it was before the earlier announcement, and the bond rates came down. Two observations. The first is it actually does get affected by those political announcements, and if political announcements are not well thought through, you can move the markets. But the other is those moves not only impacted the UK, but they impacted the US markets. You know, markets crashed dramatically. Our markets here, they went down. And the bond rates went massively high to the point where in Australia, the 2-year bond, which is a sort of an indication of where rates are going to be in 2 years' time, went to 4.3%, meaning that in 2024, they were thinking the cash rate in Australia was going to go to 4.3%, which was massively high. It's come back since then because of it's all in reverse. And that's the point here. All these things are connected internationally, right? So you've got to understand that this plumbing, these connections between the investment banks and the central banks and different countries and exchange rates and bond rates are all connected. And it's like one big lump of blancmange. It sort of wobbles this way and then wobbles that way. I don't think anybody's actually in control of it. And I don't think that anybody fully understands the way that all of these things work. But what you can also be very clear about is that you're not living in splendid isolation. So, you know, the Reserve Bank here today lifted the cash rate just by 0.5% rather than 0.25 rather than 0.5%, right? So it was half what was expected. That was a surprise. And so the markets reacted. That means that there's now going to be more pressure on exchange rate because we are going to be seen to be out of kilter with the Federal Reserve and the New Zealand and the UK and those sorts of things. So you can't make decisions in Australia about our financial system here without taking account of what's going on around the rest of the world.
Mm, it's actually, it's a very small world we live in, Master Jack. That's an old song, isn't it? our era, which we sing when we've had a few drinks. Yeah. Okay, Man from Man's Earth Band did the one too. I'll come back to you in a tick. Martin North is my guest. This is TNT Radio.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
I spy with my little eye the European weeklies. Just came in here at weatherbell.com, and they're very interesting looking. A lot of rain for northern Australia and eastern Australia coming up over the next 5 to 6 weeks. We've got the La Nina cranking. We've got what we call a cold Indian Ocean dipole. And that tries to jam a lot of upward motion into Southeast Asia, into Northern Australia, so we get a lot of rain over there. Meanwhile, let's take a look at temperatures across the globe. They're upside down again. Very mild along the north shore of Siberia all the way into Northern Canada. But from China to Africa, much of Australia, South America, in other words, the places where the weather's supposed to be warmest, it's cooler relative to averages over the next several weeks. This is weatherbell.com meteorologist Joe Bastardi for TNT Radio, asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you've got.
In this day and age, everybody deserves the right to access phone and internet services. Whether you're from regional, rural or remote Australia, the Regional Tech Hub can independently assist with providing advice on connectivity options in your local area, or work with you and your service provider to resolve outstanding issues with phone and internet. And our service is absolutely free. Find out more by visiting regionaltechhub.org.au or by calling 1300 081 029. RTH is an initiative of the Australian Government delivered by the NFF.
You have the power of information, lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
And my guest is Martin North. Before we get into other questions, I see that Liz Truss, you would think when they have a new prime minister that there's always this honeymoon period. Unfortunately, she didn't have the honeymoon. I think she's just popped into a guillotine or something. She's actually lower than Boris Johnson was when his premiership came to an end. And that also impacts too, doesn't it, the business confidence and confidence in investment throughout the UK.
Well, look, markets don't like surprises. That's one of the things to understand. And so when they came out, you know, with these very significantly changed strategies, which essentially would say we're going to make growth in the UK our number one priority. We'll grow up 2.5%. But by the way, the UK has not grown like anything like that for a long, long time. And we're going to do it by borrowing. That was enough to scare the markets dramatically, which is why we got what we got. And there was no depth to that release. There was, there's a thing called the Office of Budget Responsibility in the UK, which is meant to come up with all the numbers to prove that what they're saying they can do, they can do. Mm. They didn't do any of that. So all you got was this high-level headline, right, which was basically, we're going to borrow a shed load of money, some of which will go to help pay for energy costs, et cetera, but the rest of it's going to actually facilitate a tax cut for the most rich in the UK. That was a shocking statement. And you're right, she went straight from being a new prime minister to being on the nose. And in fact, there were people arguing, you know, literally last week, that whether she could survive the next week or two, and whether the treasurer or the chancellor, as he's called there, would actually survive. This is pretty crazy stuff. And, you know, I have to tell you that I don't think this sort of top-down trickle economics, which is what they're talking about, trickle-down economics, which is, but you make it easier for the wealthy to make more money, and then hopefully you trickle it down to the rest of the society, businesses and consumers and households. Proven not to have worked over the last 30 years, so why would it work now? It was sort of Reaganomics, you know, that sort of thing. And there's a thing called the Laffer Curve, which basically says, well, if I can reduce the tax at the top, it'll trickle down. But it's crumbs you get further down, and it takes a long time. So for me, this is a really big question from a policy and, you know, as well as a financial perspective, a policy perspective here is, I think, the question.
No, I think they were looking at the natives revolting at one stage, although they aren't terribly bad people, so they're not that revolting.
If the British think about revolting, that's you know, they love queuing, right? Mm.
Here they are, no energy, no food, and yet the elite get all this chunk of change back, and they haven't got any change to pay for their energy. It doesn't sit well, so maybe that had a bit of an impact on what the party and Liz Truss thought they should do. Going back domestically to Australia here, this is the sixth rate rise since May from the Reserve Bank. And it's, about $768 or something on a $500,000 mortgage, an extra $78 actually. Is it 78 or 768?
No, well, it depends whether you look at just this one or the total amount since it started.
That's right. This is an extra 78 on top of the rest. But what impact do you think that will have on our economy?
Well, there is interesting reaction. So some people said, see, the RBA's pivoted. So this big debate, right? Do you actually fight inflation at all costs? And, you know, inflation is really pernicious and it can really crush economies and households and businesses if it's not under control. Or do you do more quantitative easing and take rates low again, because at least that allows a little bit more of the boom in the property market to continue, right? And so you, which way do you face, right? And if I go back to the UK, right, the UK Bank of England is still talking about doing quantitative tightening later, but is doing quantitative easing now, and is still talking about putting rates up. So you've got accelerator and brake going on there, right? And here in Australia, with 25 basis points rather than 50, it sort of signals the RBA is slowing and it wants to see a little bit more about what's going on. But our core inflation here in Australia is pretty close to where the US is and pretty close to where it is in New Zealand, and yet they've got much higher rates than we have got here. So I think probably the RBA is undercooking it. The markets will probably react positively because they will argue that, well, maybe the RBA is now going to pivot and not take rates as high. But of course, the point is that those rate lifts that already happened percolate through the economy slowly. So takes about 2 to 3 months for the RBA cash rate to flow through into higher mortgage rates for real households. So we're already seeing households really struggling, and more struggle to come, I think. And the other point is it tends to dent the exchange rate as well, which basically means that we import like oil, for example, at a different price point, which is going to cost us a lot more. So the inflationary pressures could be growing because of this. And so the question is, has the RBA lost its bottle? Or is it trying to sort of steer a really sticky path between higher rates and lower rates and higher inflation and lower inflation? Will they be successful? And by the way, they're also saying, well, wages growth well, probably we'll see that, but not for some time. And they also say that inflation is going to be above the target into 2024. So this is a mess.
I'm just looking. Steve Forbes said that, and it was interesting talking about inflation. He said how they combat this is they basically make the most of the population poorer.
Yep.
And the if we look at the inflation, I mean, I'm sure it's usually it's the overspending, but you really can't say that this time. It's the cost of goods because of bad economic decisions made by government has placed an enormous amount of strain on businesses, and businesses being greedy as they can be. And the poor bugger, the consumer or the average person out there is hit between the eyes because they have no choice. So even though the price is going up, you wouldn't say it's demand exceeding supply, would you?
Well, you wouldn't, and you certainly wouldn't say that it's because of very high wages growth. Now, in the US, there is more wages growth in the system. It's not happening here yet. You know, wages growth has gone backwards in real terms for at least a decade now, and there's not much prospect of that changing. So, yeah, we imported a lot of the inflation because of the supply chain disruptions. But I'd also say that the Reserve Bank cut rates too low and did this massive amount of quantitative easing. So they flooded the economy with lots of dollars. And those, so if you think about it, those dollars are chasing the same assets. Not surprising then that house prices went through the roof and other costs rose as well. Mm. So a lot of it has been created by bad policy from the RBA and bad policy from government over the last decade plus. And by the way, the RBA, believe it or not, is actually in negative equity at the moment. So they're wearing a big loss. Why? Because they bought bonds at a particular point in the market when rates were ultra low. Now rates have gone up, and so they're sitting on the loss, which, you know, in sort of gross terms is about 40 billion, I think. You know, if you were a commercial entity with that level of loss, you'd be declared insolvent and be closed down. But of course, the RBA sails serenely through and says, well, she'll be right.
Like who are the RBA responsible to or accountable to? Is it the government, or do they have a big RBA that smacks the smaller RBA if they do bad things? I mean, where does it stop? Where does the accountability stop?
Well, the RBA is essentially appointed by the government and the treasurer, mm-hmm. right? And so they have this agreement about what the target for inflation is, et cetera, et cetera. And then the RBA is meant to be independent and objective, and it's meant to be there to maintain maximum employment and price stability. They're the two objectives that they have. They haven't done too well on either of those, in my view. And they're very bad at forecasting, so they keep forecasting wages growth and it keeps not arriving. But the other point is that the RBA, of course, is one of a number of central banks around the world. And those central banks also have a sort of dotted line, as it were, to the Bank for International Settlements, which effectively is the central banker's banker. And so sometimes you get the feeling, I think, that decisions are being sort of percolated down from central control, as it were, the central planners in the BIS, rather than actually down from the local environment. And then the question is, well, what's the relationship then between the government and the RBA? How independent is it? And there's a thing called the Council of Financial Regulators, which the Treasury and the RBA and a couple of others sit around the table and talk about things. So I'm not sure that the RBA is anything like as objective and independent as many people think it is. And, you know, there's a review going on at the moment about the role and function of the RBA, which is dead right. They should look at it. But I'm not sure they'll really get to the core question as to, well, is the RBA effective and accountable, and has it done the right things over the last few years, or has it really stuffed up? And I would say it has stuffed up by looking at this amount of negative equity they've got. And by the way, just a little side note, there's a thing called the term funding facility, which is cheap money that they lent to the banks, right? That money sits back now at the RBA, and the RBA is paying about 2.5% per annum back to the banks in interest on the cheap money they lent to the banks in the first place. So we as taxpayers are actually contributing the profits of the banks. So I hope you feel good about that.
Oh, I feel fantastic. I'm just thinking I was talking to a buddy of mine the other day, and he was talking to a bunch of mortgage brokers who said that there's going to be some real poo hitting the fan shortly when the fixed rates stop. And that the people on those fixed rates all of a sudden have to be greeted into the world of reality. What do you think will happen? Because they're going to be hit, you know, they're on 1% and, you know, very low rates, and all of a sudden, you know, that 3 years has come and gone, or 4 years has come and gone, and bang, there you are, welcome to the real world. You're going to have to pay, you know, 4 or 5%. What do you think will happen to the country then, or the economy then?
Well, it's a big deal. It's a bit like the adjustable rate loans in the US around the global financial crisis. So a lot of people are on 2% fixed rates, and over the next year to 18 months, about 500 billion of those will come to be reset. And the typical rate will now be 4, 5, or maybe even 6%, depending on your credit profile. That's a real impost on people. So that's going to be, in some cases, 50-60% more on monthly repayments on the mortgage. That's going to put a huge dent in household budgets. And therefore, people are going to really, I think, find it very difficult. And of course, the variable rate holders are hit almost immediately, but the fixed rate comes as a cliff every time, you know, the rates roll over. And I don't think it's, of course, the variable rate holders are hit almost immediately, but the fixed rate comes as a cliff every time, you know, the rates roll over. And I don't think there's any prospect that rates are going to come down in the next year or two, because RBA is still saying inflation is going to be high in 2024. So we are going to be living in a higher for longer environment, which is going to put more downward pressure on house prices, more pressure on households in terms of cash flow. They'll spend less, less economic growth. I think there's still a risk of a recession.
Yeah, I think New Guinea is looking good at this stage. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. If somebody wants to find out more about you, how do they do that?
Or they can go to my website at digitalfinanceanalytics.com. I'm also on YouTube at Walk the World, and I'm on Twitter at DFA Analyst.
Nice chatting to you once again. Thank you very much for your time. Coming up next, we'll have Omar Khan with his words and pearls of wisdom. This is TNT Radio.